My appeal tonight is to your souls more than to your minds. I begin with a story. It was first told nearly 200 years ago by a Hasidic master by the name of Nachman of Breslov. Nachman was a great-grandson of Israel Baal Shem Tov, legendary founder of Hasidism. Contemporaries knew him as an intense, involved, difficult man. We know him largely through a number of masiyot, or tales, which were written down by his disciples as he told them to them. Tales which are, in essence, personifications of the journey of the soul. And I would tell one, part of one, to you tonight. It happened in those years before the way of intense joy, the way of Hasidism had been accepted by the learned and the scholarly of our community. There was in a certain town in Eastern Europe, a learned man, scholar, a rabbi, who was revered and respected for his learning, often consulted. His life was useful, his life was full, and it lacked only one thing. He had no son. He had no one to teach, no one who would continue his traditions, no one who would say Kaddish for him when he died. The old man longed for a son and prayed for a son, and one year God was good to them, and they had a son. The son was fair of form and bright and alert, delight to his father. Father began to teach him all that he knew. He taught him Torah, and he taught him Talmud, he taught him the Midrash, he taught him of Jewish philosophy. And the boy was a sponge, he learned quickly. And he mastered most of the basic traditions of our people. He was the apple of his father's eye. And then one day, as the son sat down to his studies and he looked on the page, his eye couldn't concentrate on the text. His soul had flown out of the window, and there it was dancing over the green fields, walking deep into the dark forests, walking into the marketplace of the city, seeing what life was like among the simple folk of the town. His father noticed that his mind was wandering and tried to call him back to his studies, but he couldn't concentrate. He couldn't concentrate one day and the next. Then the young man began furtively to follow his soul out of the window, to walk out into the fields, into the dark of the forest, and into the marketplace of the city. His father was angry with him and reprimanded him for his inattention to his Torah, to his study. And under the anger and of his father, the young man began to grow visibly paler and weaker. And the simple folk of the town began to notice this change in the boy's aspect, and they began to speak of him of a holy man, a tzaddik, who lived some villages away, who was known, so they told him, for his ability to cure the soul. Why not go to him, see if he can't cure your soul? The boy asked, is the holy man learned? And the simple folk of the town said, we don't know if he is learned, but we do know that when he speaks, we understand. Well, is he truly a holy man? We're not sure. When we know that when he prays, God seems near. So the young man went to his father, and he asked his father if he would take him on a visit to the holy man. And his father poo-pooed the whole thing. He's nothing but a country faith healer. Pay no attention. He's not a scholar. He has nothing to teach you. It's all in the books. Learn. And the boy tried to learn, but he couldn't concentrate. And he grew every day weaker and paler and more sickly. And finally, the heart of his father was near to breaking, and he said, fine, I can do no else. I'll take you to this holy man, despite what I think of him. But I want you to know that I'm not certain of what I'm doing, and if there's any sign along the way that God doesn't want us to go, we're going to turn back, if we're going to come home. And so they set out, a simple wagon drawn by some mules. And they went a few miles along the way, and suddenly an animal darted across the street, and the mules began to gallop, and the wagon lurched forward, and it lurched it sideways into a ditch, and it overturned. And when the wagoneer had been able to right the wagon, the father, convinced the sign had been given to him, ordered the wagoneer to turn the wagon about and return home. And the boy sat down to his studies and became visibly weaker every day. Finally, the father could bear it no longer. We'll set out again, but with the same conditions. So they set out. And the wagon went this time a few miles further than it had gone the first time. But then there was suddenly a chuck hole in the road, and the wagon wheel caught in the chuck hole, and the axle of the wagon broke. And when the wagoneer had finally fixed the axle of his wagon, the father, sadly, ordered the wagon about to return home. And the boy sat down to his studies. The boy grew weaker every day. The boy died. So far the story. Clearly it's a story about the need of the soul for a living faith. The boy had wrapped his mind about the content about of our tradition, about our law and about our literature and about our philosophy, but he had yet no living experience with the faith. The light of faith was not bright in his soul. The fact that his mind was stuffed with the faith traditions is not enough. He needed for the faith to be vital, full, vivid. Now let's for the moment move from the 18th century to our own. Let's look about us, at our world, at our country. And I'm sure you know, have noticed, as I have noticed, how much faith has become part of our public life. It used to be that faith was one of those matters which one was not supposed to talk about, at least in public, and certainly not in good company. The talk of faith was deemed somehow to be awkward. Someone might feel ill at ease. And so while one nominally listed what one's denomination or affiliation was, there was no witness or no testimony of one's faith made. But now we're part and parcel of a national election in which both of the candidates are not only making public professions of belonging to some church, some denomination, but they're taking delight in telling with us precisely what that faith means to them, their experiences with their faith. President Ford has told us not only about the pieties of his family, but he's told us with pride that he has a son who was enrolled in a divinity school in Boston, an evangelical seminary. And when he's been pressed by reporters, well, Mr. President, how do you find the answer to the difficult problems? He's been given to quoting to them from the third chapter of the book of Proverbs. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not upon your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him. He will direct your path. And his challenger for the office of the presidency, Mr. Carter, is not only a sometime Sunday school teacher in the Plains Baptist Church in Georgia, but he's a self-acknowledged, reborn Christian who delights to talk publicly, and he talks easily and naturally of his experience in accepting the Christ, the moment of conversion to his true faith, and what a living and vital faith means to him. Now this public talk about faith, about the living experience of the faith, is not simply a phenomenon of this election, something that will come up in the night and disappear in the night, come up with this election and disappear in November. Not at all. The American community more and more over the last decade or so has been experimenting with faith and talking about faith and seeking faith. For a decade now, Billy Graham and other evangelicals have been filling the stadia of our country, filling arenas which can be filled only by by sports teams with tens of thousands of people who come to hear and to listen, and hundreds of them come down to the altar and accept their Lord. And many a home in America of nominal Christians or nominal Jews has suddenly found itself disturbed, distressed, tensioned by a young person who has begun to take faith seriously and decided to move out to a chavura, or to join the Jesus people, or even by young people who have moved away from their ancestral traditions because they seem cold or barren to them, who have turned to some charismatic leader, some guru, to some Zen master for their enlightenment, for the moment of faith. Americans have a thirst for faith. This thirst has been building up over the generations. It's time that we come to deal with it, to acknowledge it, to respond to it. Why has this happened? Abraham Isaac Kook was the chief rabbi of Palestine in the 20s and 30s of our century, the years of the Yishuv. It's a fascinating mind, one of the most important religious thinkers of the century among our people. He was an activist in the community, which was relatively passive, which made a virtue of patience, of waiting for the coming of the Messiah. He was a practical Zionist who left Eastern Europe and went to Palestine at a time when most of his community was content to pray, to await for the miraculous renewal of that community. He was a halakhist, scholar, note, who yet had understanding of the heart of common people, and who was himself a mystic. So 40 years ago, he wrote in a speech a paragraph which I'd like to share with you this evening, where it explains his soul and, to a certain degree, our condition in our time. Rav Kook wrote, "So long as the world moves along accustomed paths, so long as there are no wild catastrophes, man can find sufficient substance for his life by contemplating surface events, theories, and movements of society. He can acquire his inner richness from this external kind of property. But this is not the case when life encounters fiery forces of evil and chaos. Then the revealed world begins to totter. Then the man who tries to sustain himself only from the surface aspects of existence will suffer terrible impoverishment, begin to stagger. Then he will feel welling up within himself a burning thirst for that inner substance and vision which transcends the obvious surfaces of existence and remains unaffected by the world's catastrophe. From such inner sources, he will seek the waters of joy which can quicken the dry outer skeleton of existence." And we have come, I believe, to a moment in time when it is no longer satisfying for us to move along the accustomed paths. We're not certain that they lead to a useful end. And we have lived in a world which has known evil and chaos, Stalin and Hitler and the Holocaust. And we live through dangerous times, confusing times. The world seems to stagger about us and to totter. And we have lost our sense of balance. And we're no longer confident that the mind unaided, the laboratory, the library, all of our research can take us through and lead us through. We need a higher vision and a deeper feeling. We need, most of us at least, some confidence, the confidence that is born of faith in the living God. And so we turn to faith if we're not afraid to. We're not too timid. We're not too much preachers of an older time which made a supreme virtue of human reason of the superficial and surface things. We turn, seek to open our hearts, seek to respond. Now there are some among us who somehow think of this movement of religious renewal as vaguely un-Jewish. After all, these are Christian men speaking of Christian experiences. One day not so long ago, some of us were talking about this religious phenomenon, and I was trying to explain to them the theology of a newborn Christian, how what the word meant. And one who was sitting around said finally to me, "You know, that's all very interesting, but you can't imagine, can you, a reborn Jew, a born-again Jew?" As if he was saying to me, that's their mishigas, and we don't have to worry about it. Now, it's true. There has never been a born-again Jew, and there never will be. We do not share with Christians the doctrine of the fall or the concept of original sin. We don't believe that one has to be born again, justified by faith, in order to, through discipline and will, turn one's soul in a direction satisfying to God and find one's way to a faith which is sustained. We don't believe that we come into this world with our souls shackled by the sin of Adam, unable to free themselves unless somehow God breaks in. We don't need to be born again in order to be saved. But you know, the first reborn Christian was a man known as Paul of Tarsus. And as he testifies in his letter to the Romans, he came to this new experience out of a sense of being estranged from God, alienated, burdened by a sin from which he couldn't, from a concept of sin from which he couldn't shake himself loose, by feeling that he was somehow so much a sinner that he would never be acceptable to God. He found that somehow through a life of piety, his prayer, and through this experience of the inrush of the Spirit, he suddenly felt reborn, renewed. Life took on new meaning. Now that's a peculiar Christian experience. But it's not so far away from what many Jews have felt if we strip from it these peculiar Christian doctrines. But what is Yom Kippur this day, this night? Is it not a night to turn to God and to find God turning to us? What do we call Yom Kippur in English? The Day of Atonement, the Day of At-One-ment, when we are hopefully at one with God, and God is at one with us. Now, I have no shame of testifying publicly to the experience of faith which can come on Yom Kippur. I know that I approach this day diffidently yet hopefully. For on this day in years past, I have come to understand something of the surge of the Spirit. I've come to feel one with myself and one with my people and one with my God in a way which, though it does not radically transform me, it allows me to carry on through the year, encouraged, sustained. I've tried to understand the magic, the miracle, the mood of Yom Kippur, which can do this to my soul. There's something to do with the shrill, natural cry of the shofar, which breaks through the customary and calls me to the moment. I come here as do you from the burdens of the day. Suddenly we enter the beauty of this sanctuary, and I move to say, surely God is in this place. Ach no ra, ma no ra, hamakom hazeh, how awesome is this place. And I am welcomed here by the minor key melodies of the Kol Nidre, which vibrate with 100 generations of loyalty and of martyrdom. Somehow, if I let my soul loose, I feel one with this long march of our people from Sinai till now. And as I speak the words of confession, not once, but twice, not only in the evening, but in the morning and the afternoon, it take on new life for me. It suddenly breaks the shell of all my defenses. I suddenly recognize my weaknesses, many of them at least. And there's something encouraging in that recognition, for the more I recognize my weaknesses, the more I recognize my ability to transcend them. And I am at one at that moment with the congregation, with all, for all of us are weak and all of us wish better for ourselves. And there is the silence, and there is the whiteness, and there is the discipline of the fasting, and there is the sense of community, all of us seeking, all of us on the way, all of us searching for the experience. Somehow through the day, the book, the music, the moments, the sanctuary blend together. The Spirit moves. Just as Paul says, and the Christians feel that they are received in Christ, so Jews on this day feel that they are received again by God, forgiven. There is the half-believed legend, you know, the legend of the open book, a court. My life written out in the book, my sins, my accomplishments, the balance, the decision, who shall live and who shall die, who is worthy and who is not. It's legend, it's words of worship, it's a building, it's notes of music, but somehow it blends together. It's magic, it's a moment. The soul reaches out, God. Reach in. The master was asked by his pupil, where is God? And the answer came back, God is wherever man will let him in. But you know, there's a strange thing about us as a people. Probably of all groups in America today, we are those who are least able, or at least seem least able, to let God in, to allow the moment to speak to us. Probably of all groups in America, we are those who are trying most desperately to hold out against fate, keep everything very logical and very rational, very academic. We're a very verbal people. And I hear us talking about many things, about the business of the Jewish community, about the world of the Father, about Israel, about Soviet anti-Semitism. But I almost never hear us talk about faith, about a moment in prayer in which things seem to be holy, which we transcended the moment. I rarely hear Jews talk about their faith in God. Somehow with us, faith is still in the closet. And we're somehow put off by others who can speak easily and naturally of their faith. But why should it be among us? What are we afraid of? Some of us are afraid of an age of faith. With good reason. The age of faith was not a pleasant time for us, Jews. It was the time of the ghetto, the time of the yellow badge, time when the Jews were treated as pariahs, as outcasts, for some presumed ancient sin. We know that men of faith often make a distinction between themselves and the faithless, those outside the law. We know that the evangelicals in our country often describe heaven as a kind of restricted subdivision and look on the unconverted as a mission field. But you know, I refuse not to love simply because many cannot love successfully. There is no reason to deny us faith because there are dangers implicit in the moment of faith. And there are excesses among the faithful. We have this moment, a moment of love, a moment of community, a moment of confession, a moment of contrition. A moment in which our souls should be open to God. Why don't we take advantage of it? Why don't we as Jews for once let go? And let our souls speak. Become again a holy congregation. Hila Kedosha. That's the real distinction between Jewish piety and Christian piety. Christian piety is very private. Christians have the concept of testimony, of confession, where a man or a woman will rise up on a Wednesday night or a Sunday morning and speak easily and openly of their experience of faith in the Christ. And they think of themselves as individuals in a world of the unconverted. We're a more corporate group. We think of ourselves as a congregation of loyalists, if you will, in an unconverted or uncaring world. And our moments with God tend to be congregational, with the family and with the congregation. This kind of corporate piety or mysticism, in a sense, protects us from many of the excesses of piety. One of the travesties of piety is the man who professes his faith, whose faith does not change him, does not make him intensely righteous, intensely concerned with the welfare of others. We've had the experience recently of one of the bad boys of the Watergate White House finding his faith in a parked car after good food and good drink with a millionaire in Washington, suddenly having illumination and writing a book, self-serving, exculpating himself in order to prove that he is reborn in the faith. He may be reborn, but he hasn't been changed. We are here, a congregation. Holiness is with us not simply a moment's experience, but that moment of experience with God, a God who demands of us righteous living. Holy shalt thou be, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. That's our reading this Yom Kippur day. Holiness, that's our hope this Yom Kippur day, to sense the holiness of God and the holiness within and to bind these two together. And in what does holiness consist? In the moment, in the feeling, and in the law. Curse not the deaf. Put no obstacle before the blind. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt leave the corner of thy field for the poor. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Holiness with us, sense of being received by God. It's all involved with the morality, the ethics, the righteousness, the teachings of our tradition. The movement of the soul must always be a movement towards a God who demands righteous living of us, as well as openness of the Spirit. God is there. We only have the courage to let him in. And you know, I'm quite convinced that there are far more believers in our congregation than most of us would ever conceive. You reveal it in so many little ways. You say to me from time to time about a service or a moment, but it was cold, which means simply, I was timid, I cried, but I didn't have the experience of my soul. And you say to me, half diffidently, you know, I'm really around the temple for the good of my children, if you're around the temple. You're trying, all of us are, to break through the shell. The shell which somehow makes us feel that faith is something for children, or for the innocent, or passé, or medieval. Faith sustains life. God is everywhere. Let me conclude the story of the old man and his son. A modern conclusion, my own. The old man buried his son, Bathsheba, said Kaddish. And when the 30 days of mourning were over, he called the wagon driver to him and said, I want to set out on the way. I want to go to visit the holy man. And they set out on the way, the lone father now. And they went some miles beyond their first accident and some miles beyond their second. And as they pushed on, suddenly the skies became very dark. There were storm clouds all about. And up the road a piece, a farmer stood beside the side of the road, and he waved the wagoner down and said to him, "Perhaps you ought to turn into my farm. I've heard reports that there are terrible storms ahead. I've even heard reports that the road may be washed out." The old man, the wagoneer, looked back at the rabbi, the old man, the father. The old man, the father, nodded and said, "Push on. Push on tonight. Push on tomorrow. Allow this Yom Kippur to be a moment, an experience, in which your soul opens up, God, to our people, to the God that is within you. Amen."